Hey everyone, just a quick note before we start the podcast. If you are enjoying these, make sure you subscribe to the podcast to stay up to date on all the new releases. It's also super helpful if you can leave a review in Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you listen to this on. If you enjoy the holistic message we're spreading here and think more people need to hear this, your reviews help push the podcast up the podcast charts and more people find it, listen, and make the world a better place. And if you want to get even more from us, including weekly newsletters highlighting the latest and greatest in nootropic and mental health news and research, along with first dibs on new content and partner product deals, make sure you go on over to holisticnootropics.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and sign up with your name and email. I promise I won't spam you. Your support means the world to me and keeps this whole project going. With that, let's get into the podcast.
You're listening to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast, your home for holistic, evidence-based cognitive enhancement strategies. And now your host, Eric Levi.
Hey, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast, where we discuss holistic, lifestyle-based cognitive enhancement. My name is Eric. I'm a functional nutritional therapy practitioner. And today on the podcast, I have Yulia Brockdorf. Yulia is a dietitian and licensed professional counselor. She is board certified in advanced diabetes management, diabetes education, sex therapy, and EMDR, which is an evidence-based trauma treatment intervention. She serves on several boards, and in her practice, she strives to integrate the fields of clinical mental health and counseling and psychotherapy and dietetics. Now, me and Yulia had an in-depth conversation all about essentially how diet affects mental health. We talk about different foods that are good for mental health, different cases that she sees in her practice. She gives some amazing recommendations for literature and studies and books to read up on that talk a lot about the deep inner workings of the brain and different therapies that can heal things like trauma. She works with trauma in her practice, so we talk about her EMDR therapy that she uses for deep trauma. We talk about different diets, and we talk about bioindividuality. Now, all of the show notes, including all of the links to everything we talk about, including all the scientific references, can all be found at holisticnootropics.com/Yulia. Also, if you are new to nootropics or want to learn more about using supplements, diet, and lifestyle to hack your brain for peak performance, check out holisticnootropics.com. With no further ado, everybody, enjoy my podcast today with Yulia Brockdorf. Yulia Brockdorf, welcome to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, you have a very interesting background. You're a dietitian, you work with integrative medicine, and you also work with psychotherapy. And so I'm kind of wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you blend your background in nutrition into working with essentially helping patients and clients improve their mental health.
It started with nutrition. I was always interested in functional and integrative medicine. And over the years of being a dietitian, I've discovered that many patients have histories of significant trauma that may impede their capacity to make behavioral changes, make nutritional changes that are important for them. At the same time, I've discovered many patients with mental health concerns, be it depression, anxiety, or the trauma I mentioned, can benefit from nutritional modification. So over the years, after being a dietitian, decided to go back to school and now became also a licensed professional counselor here in Oregon. And now try to complement using various tools and skills that I have to make an individual plan for individual patients with whom we work together and in development of that plan.
I feel like the nutrition aspect in counseling and mental health therapies is such a powerful tool that's so underutilized by, I mean, just about the entire mainstream medical, you know, psychotherapy system.
Well, there's also an issue of scope of practice. to utilize nutritional intervention in psychotherapy, a person needs to be trained in nutrition and in the state to be allowed to deliver nutritional suggestion to the patient. So not every provider will be able to, even if they do have the training, to implement the training and caring for their patients. So physicians who do have the scope of practice permitted to do that may have that option, but many psychotherapists or psychologists might not be able to utilize these tools. However, nutrition is really vitally important as it impacts both delivery of nutrients to the brain with the food we eat, and as well as various factors and various nutrients you consume, that not just macronutrients, but micronutrients like flavanols, flavones, and various anthocyanins that comes from our plant kingdom foods that impact quality of brain cells, quality of myelination of the cells, and capacity for the brain to be plastic, to rewire, to create new connections as we are engaging in psychotherapy, while at the same time fostering this new growth of the neuronal cells.
Yeah. And when you think about something like an SSRI, for instance, right, we're talking about, it seems to me the idea of that is to make serotonin more available in the brain.
Synaptical junction, right.
Exactly. So when you're talking about, well, how do we make serotonin more available in the brain? To me, it makes sense to say, well, the body should just make more serotonin. And you know, how do you do that? Well, serotonin, like most neurotransmitters, is made through amino acids.
Right.
So, you know, it makes sense to me that you know, as a therapist, you know, the fact that even if you're not licensed to use nutrition, there's so many nutritionists out there.
Education could be provided, definitely. And like you mentioned, serotonin, which is5-hydroxytryptamine, for those who want to kind of look up in the scientific literature, the term for serotonin is 5-hydroxytryptamine. And it's made out of amino acid tryptophan. Tryptophan is an amino acid that can fight for the cross of blood-brain barrier with other amino acids. And yet there it metabolizes into 5-hydroxytryptophan, which is 5-HTP. You can also find it as a supplement over the counter. And 5-hydroxytryptophan is a 1-decarboxylase reaction short of conversion to 5-hydroxytryptamine, which is serotonin. Now, interestingly, large percentage of serotonin is going to reside in our gut. So back to connecting nutrition and mental health and overall health holistically, gut motility is enlarged, is going to be governed by the serotonin receptor function as well. Yes.
Oh, no, go ahead.
As a patient, for example, decides to self-treat, which I don't recommend to self-treat, oftentimes your body will metabolize, let's say, the 5-HTP into serotonin right there in the gut. And a lot of side effects could be experienced in the gut. So over time, you also will have benefit in the brain. But at first, it could be experienced. So some people can be frightened to take it and then terminate before noticing any mental health improvement from it. And of course, there is a caution as far as combination of 5-HTP with SSRI. However, under supervision, this can be done successfully.
Yeah, well, you said a couple things there that are so important to think about, which is A, you know, when it comes to something like 5-HTP, you know, you can't experience too much serotonin, right? You can experience the serotonin syndrome, which is basically overdosing on serotonin, which is
very threatening, very scary. You have tachycardia, people can see dilation of their pupils, often symptoms like heart in the neck for some people, and it could be very dangerous and requires medical attention.
Right. And then you said something else on top of that, which is this is all metabolized in your gut. So the gut makes 90% of the serotonin that ends up in your brain. But the problem is so many people have these ridiculous gut issues, you know? I mean, and I don't mean ridiculous, like it's ridiculous to have it, but it, I mean, ridiculous amounts of gut issues.
Tough, and it causes a lot of suffering for many, many people.
Right. And it makes sense because, you know, going back to food, you know, I like to look at the business side too, which is just look at the numbers that companies like Kraft and General Mills and PepsiCo and Coca-Cola and, you know, all of these fast food companies. I mean, these are billion-dollar companies. And, you know, those dollars don't just show up. They show up because people are using the product.
Because of consuming. We are consumers. We vote with our dollars on a daily basis with the choices we make, with the food we buy, with clothes we wear, with the cars we drive, right?
Exactly.
And I just wanted to set it out there to your listeners that serotonin itself, you will see some supplements for serotonin in the market. I've seen them. Serotonin is not able to cross blood-brain barrier. Some claim it does, but it really is not. It's too large to cross blood-brain barrier. So whatever serotonin is made in the periphery, it stays in the periphery. Whatever is made in the CNS, in the central nervous system, stays in the brain. So kind of be aware of those claims that you can take serotonin and all of a sudden you're going to have increased central nervous system serotonin. It's usually a precursor, be it food-derived or a supplement-derived, that will impact the CNS serotonin.
Right. It's like you have to get your body to make it, basically, because that's the only way. And I read something recently, GABA is very much the same way.
So GABA. I sometimes use GABA just to kind of, if I need a litmus test for patients who are exposed to heavy metals, and before we do fancy testing or ask physicians to be involved, I sometimes actually give patients GABA to see whether or not they feel better. And I really hope they don't, because GABA should not be crossing blood-brain barrier. And if it does, we've got a problem bigger than we thought. So that's kind of how I use GABA. I have a bundle jar of it just for that purpose.
That's really interesting you do that. That is, I mean, it's almost like you're showing people, because people probably come in and they go, you know, and I've seen this as a practitioner myself. I say, well, what supplements are you taking? And they'll bring me a big bag of supplements.
Oh, yes.
So it's not for lack of trying that these people don't feel well, but they're doing it in such a way that they just don't know what to take anymore, because they've heard from one person. It's like, well, you know what helped me maybe feel better? GABA. And then they'll go to the health food store and then they'll buy GABA and then they'll take it and they'll take it and they'll be like, I still don't feel better. And so what you're saying is please, by all means, take it so you can see yourself, because I guess in a way too, seeing essentially you're training yourself to realize that you're really just relying on placebo more than anything.
Yes. And there are things that help with experience of GABA, like calming, which would be amino acid theanine found in green tea, the skullcap, milky oats. There are things that kind of help to have that passion flower, hops. So there are multiple herbals and amino acids that could be used to kind of have that nice and peaceful anxiety and psycholytic activity influence on experience for patients.
Absolutely. And just to go back to GABA, you know, much like serotonin, I was reading this paper about, you know, the gut microbiome, and there's a company I was reading about there in Cambridge, and it's one of these companies who they're calling it the psychobiome now.
Psychobiome. And, yes. Yeah.
So it's like what they're doing is these guys are on the forefront of essentially trying to create therapies that manipulate gut bacteria to build neurotransmitters. And so what they found was they found about 30 strains of gut bacteria that actually make GABA. And this is the GABA that actually does cross the blood-brain barrier. So instead of giving a patient GABA, the future of this therapy will be give the patient or optimize for that specific gut bacteria that makes GABA that actually crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Yes, that's very interesting. And there was a study done in Australia, I believe it was 80-some people with cognitive decline that were put on Mediterranean-type diet and keto diet. And both were found to improve cognition. Looking at various other markers, kind of like how did it work, perhaps reduction of LDL, a reduction of the CRP, reduction of blood pressure could be some of the factors. But the other element was also looking at the gut flora. And they found with utilizing these diets, Mediterranean or keto, they had increased bifidobacterium.
Yeah, that's an important one, is the bifido and the lactobacillus. And you know, mm-hmm. that's the other thing too, is now you start talking about, people hear that and they go, okay, well, I'm going to go out
and get some pills.
Yes, yes, exactly. And they go out and they run out and they're like, I get these probiotics. And then, you know, when you go see probiotics, it's like an arms race for the amount of colony forming units of the, yes. of the probiotic. And it's like, this one has 100 million CFUs. And then this one has 1 billion CFUs. And then this one has 100 million CFUs. And at some point you naturally go for the one with more because you think it's better. But in the end, most of those probiotics, and I'm pro probiotic, by the way, right. I'm not anti probiotic, but the fact is most of them are just not made well, and most of them don't even
survive. Yeah.
They don't survive by the time you get home.
Yes, when they leave the factory, they're supposed to have them. But after that, the manufacturing is done in the way that only a few survive, and if any at all. And you know, we have some prescription ones that have good survivability, but other than that, there's not much. So to get them from food, to get them from your daily playing with the dirt experiences, just eating your real food grown in your gardens as much as possible, fermented foods, be it sauerkraut, be it pickled beets, natto, kimchi, for those who consume dairy, kefir, which has so many different species in it as well. Those are great ways to get your probiotics. And also keep being mindful of prebiotics. Prebiotics are soluble fibers that your probiotics, the bugs, will enjoy consuming, enjoy eating. So they are like chicory root, they are Jerusalem artichoke, also known as sunchokes, watercress. There are various lovely, lovely prebiotics. Jicama, it's very ubiquitous, it's cheap, and jicama provides outstanding prebiotic to your probiotic foods.
Yeah, the prebiotic part is the part that now that's starting to become what probiotics was like 3 or 4 years ago. So now you have all these companies coming out and making prebiotic powders. And personally, I can get on board with the idea of probiotics. Only if they're good probiotics. Personally, I like spore-based probiotics because they seem to survive the right. gastrointestinal lining. But the prebiotics, to me, I feel like you said, that is best obtained from food. So like all the foods you mentioned, you know, I've heard about different starchy vegetables that are good mm-hmm. for that are really good for prebiotics. Resistant starch is something I've always really been into.
Yeah, and like even your sweet potatoes, you know, there's so many different fun things you can have.
Yeah, so you were talking about diets, and yeah. you know, look, like as a nutritional therapy practitioner, you know, I keep my eyes on all the diets, and I've done mm-hmm. a few of them myself. But I'm curious to know, you know, what your view is on diets or protocols, and if there's any that you personally recommend.
Well, of course, for personal recommend would be individualized, because what kind of general even research says, for example, there was a PERIMED study, I think 522 patients were enrolled, and they compared olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, or nuts against the low-fat diet. And that particular study found after 6.5 years improvement in cognition. However, low-fat diet did not have the same findings, but both nuts and extra virgin olive oil did. And there was later on follow-up study, was called New Age. I don't remember how many subjects were enrolled in that, but they found improvement in episodic memory acquisition. So there are some really kind of like broad foundational dietary principles that are rooted in consumption of high quality plant-based fat versus no fat or low fat versus a saturated fat versus omega-6 fat, as well as high intake of roots, vegetables, and the more colors, the better. So we have green leafy vegetables, let's say beets, which increase nitric oxide, blueberries. Oh, there was another study. It was done in kids. I think it was 50-some kids. It was looked at a consumption of equivalency of 150 grams, which is like a cup and a half-ish, 2 cups of blueberries. But I think they consumed it in a form of juice. And they did had this drink like 2 hours before a task was given. And they've had a wonderful improvement in acquisition and also improvement in memory overall for these kids. So the colors, the vibrancy of the variety of various nutrients that will be acquired from diet tends to have good literature support behind it. And then individual has to look to suggest to one particular patient versus the other. That would be, of course, taking into consideration all of their metabolic and health history and milieu of their health.
Yeah, the diet obsession, the protocol obsession has been on the front of my mind specifically for the last couple of days, because I've been listening to a lot of people talk, and I've had a number of conversations with other practitioners about these protocols. And people, a lot of practitioners and doctors, they sell their protocol. And you know, I come from the background of, like you said, individuality, bio-individuality, right. You know, especially now that we know so much about genetics and epigenetics and SNPs, and, you know, we know about environmental histories and like where a person lives and, you know, and your family's history, right? Like you're right. Eastern European, your family for probably hundreds, thousands of years was eating a very different food than somebody who comes from South America ate. So sure. Your body's going to react completely different to, you know, certain foods versus other people. So I think absolutely. What happens is a lot of people get obsessed with a diet, and then they almost, you know, pin themselves into a corner because they become so dogmatic with a diet that, yeah. And I think every diet, no matter what, even the worst diets, have benefits that you're going to see, but then eventually I think there's diminishing returns, and depending on, you know, how intense you follow the diet, you'll start to experience those returns.
Absolutely. And we don't want diet to become a cult or another form of a low four-letter word. I believe it's, when we look at memory, when we look at improvement of cognition, improvement of neurodegeneration, of brain plasticity, a decreasing cerebral oxidation and reactive oxidative species, removing beta amyloid plaques, supporting patients' oxygenation of the brain. When all of those factors take into account, it's not something you can really do in like 2 weeks, you're done, or 3 months. It's a lifelong, it's a long-term process to people have to impact these endpoints and as well do it in some manner that is viable. So short-term diets that maybe even will show particular benefit and particular marker, but they may not be sustainable for lifelong lifestyle to still impact those endpoint markers. So I tend to lean on eating plans that are doable, that are synchronous with patients' preferences and likes and dislikes, and individualize that this is something person can doesn't have to forever go on and off. And they can just simply live that way.
Yeah, it's really about introducing people to foods that, you know, maybe for whatever reason, they just never had them. And then, you know, you kind of say, well, you know, if you look at your history and you look kind of where you are now, I mean, there are foods that you're leaving out that maybe if you introduce them one at a time and you see how you like them, especially if you can figure out a way for people to create their own recipes for these things and really, you know, it's about compliance in the end, right? You can't try to have a client or a patient, you know, make a food because you think it's healthy for them, but they just have no ability to make, you know, it's like in the wellness industry, you know, on my side, I come from more of like a Weston A. Price type, you know, nutrition background, and everybody loves liver, right? Beef liver is like what's going to solve everything. And I love beef liver, but you know, most people either A, can't get their hands on beef liver, or B, can't stand it, you know? So
not everybody's going to like it. That's right. And it needs to be healthy, safe liver if you're going to do that. It cannot be a liver from your regular grocery store at $2.99 a pound.
Exactly. That's the other part to it too, which is I get my beef liver from a farm that I know where the cow, like it's the most beautiful, you know, part of Puerto Rico. These cows eat just this lovely grass and they're raised right. But, you know, when somebody hears liver, I mean, most people are going to like a commercial grocery store and, you know, we know that all the toxins of all of the crap that the cow ate and all of the stress hormones and everything gets stored in the liver. So when you eat the liver, you're actually eating a lot of toxic material.
Absolutely. This is where nutrients are and this is where the toxins are.
Yeah.
Like it's piggyback on what you're saying, just even small nutritional modification, let's say turmeric. There was some interesting literature looking at the turmeric and impact of turmeric on cognitive decline, on memory, and just utilizing that in cooking, creating like turmeric paste and keep it in the fridge and adding a teaspoon to make a golden milk or something. It's a great antioxidant, not only helpful in the peripheral antioxidant quality, it's COX-2 inhibitor, but also in the cerebral function. And literature looking at the utilization of turmeric on a 12-week basis, which takes several weeks to really increase the levels to the biologically active state. And in that case, utilizing something like that in food would be greatly beneficial. Or saffron in cooking as well.
Yeah, I've heard great things about saffron.
It needs to be high doses, right?
Yeah,
and long-term memory.
And turmeric's an interesting one because, again, turmeric's another one that I get it from the farmer's market and I get the whole root.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I'll use it like in smoothies. I'll just go for the root. But then you have the powders and there's a lot of shenanigans in the turmeric powder industry, which, again, if you go to just a commercial grocery store and you get like McCormick's turmeric off of the spice aisle, I mean, there's a good chance that turmeric has, you know, hidden heavy metals in it, or some kind of toxic material in it. In fact, I believe you can just Google McCormick spices and heavy metals, and there's just a whole laundry list of articles that pop up where they've tested these different spices in just grocery store spice racks that, you know, and from what I understand, it's because a lot of these spices come from China, and in China, the farmers get paid by the weight of their yield. So if you have a turmeric farmer in China, what he's doing is he's making that powder, but then he's sprinkling in like lead or iron, something to weigh it down. And of course, nobody can really inspect that. So, you know, even when you try to be healthy, it's like there's all of these little hurdles that you have to watch out for. Hey, everybody. Just wanted to take a second to break away from the podcast to tell you about my favorite pre-formulated nootropic stack. That is MindLab Pro. I look at MindLab Pro kind of like a nootropic multivitamin. If you're a nootropic newbie, this is a great nootropic stack to start with. Even if you're an experienced nootropic user, maybe you've been putting together your own kind of different stacks using different nootropics together, and maybe you've hit a plateau, maybe you just haven't found the one that works right for you. Maybe you found something that worked right and then you try to pair it with something else and the whole thing kind of fell apart and then that original nootropic doesn't work for you. MindLab Pro is pre-formulated. It's made by scientists, so they actually pre-formulate it with the right amounts, the right ingredients, 11 research-backed nootropic ingredients, by the way, that are proven to help boost your cognition, your memory, your focus, your mood, all those benefits you look for out of a nootropic, especially a nootropic stack, you're going to get with MindLab Pro. You've got acetylcholine, which is going to boost your acetylcholine production. It's going to boost dopamine. It's going to boost your focus. It's going to boost your memory, your processing. processing speed. You've got phosphatidylserine, which is going to help you with nerve growth factor. It's got glucose metabolism enhancement. You've got the modulation of the HPA axis. It's going to help your energy levels. It's going to help your mood. It's going to help your stress levels, which is so important. You've got Bacopa monnieri. You've got rhodiola, an amazing adaptogenic herb. You got one of the most popular nootropic or holistic nootropics out there, lion's mane mushroom. You're getting that nerve growth factor, literally growing new brain, promotes healthy brain cell function. So many amazing benefits from lion's mane. You've also got things like maritime pine bark extract, and of course, N-acetyl L-tyrosine, which is going to help boost dopamine levels, and of course, norepinephrine levels. So if you need a boost in mood, if you're dealing with some depression, if you just need to be a little bit more lively, let's say you're kind of falling apart going out in social situations, assuming you're breaking your social distancing, you're going out, you need a little N-acetyl L-tyrosine. And then of course, one of the classic great nootropics, L-theanine, hit that alpha brainwave, get into flow. If you're trying to pair something with coffee to take the edge off a little bit, or if you're just getting rid of caffeine in general, L-theanine is a great nootropic amino acid. And then you have the cofactors, the B vitamins to help really put everything together, B6, B9, B12, you know, it's like you can have all these amazing nootropics together, but if you don't turn on the fire, if you don't stir the pot, that's what the B vitamins do. They help get everything together so that it's metabolized, it hits your brain, it works the way it's supposed to do. Right now, we have a deal with MindLab Pro directly through holisticnootropics.com. You get 3 months of MindLab Pro with an extra fourth month for free. Just go on over to holisticnootropics.com/MindLab Pro. Again, holisticnootropics.com/MindLab Pro. Get 1 free month of MindLab Pro with the purchase of 3. You can't beat this deal. The nootropic multivitamin, MindLab Pro, my favorite. Okay, let's get back into the podcast.
Yeah, going back to the root itself, no pun intended, it truly is a great approach. I was in India right before the whole coronavirus thing started, end of January, and there's a cool dish that my relative made there. And that he's a physician in India, and he took a regular turmeric root, chopped up in small little pieces and marinated them almost like on a counter and make it like a pickled turmeric. That was the yummiest thing ever.
And it sounds so delicious.
It was so good. It's very easy to consume, like gobs and gobs of the turmeric. I mean, I would have my breakfast and I would probably have half a cup of turmeric because it was fermented food and it was turmeric food and it was surely yummy. It's a great litmus test to see how well you brush your teeth. Yeah, you really can tell if you didn't do a good job afterwards.
Yeah, turmeric's one of those where it's like it's like a murder scene if you use too much of it. It definitely leaves its mark for sure. I want to go back for a minute, and we're talking a lot about nutrition, and we'll move on to some other topics soon. But you were mentioning the keto diet, and you know, and I like the idea of the keto diet. It's grown so popular, and I'm sure you have patients and clients that come in asking you about the keto diet because it is so popular. And on one hand, personally, I like the keto diet, but I also think it has introduced a lot of complicating ideas to people. I like the idea that we're starting to become more tolerant of fat as a macronutrient, because for years, everybody just said, you can't eat fat. And when people looked at a food label, I know this was me, you look, okay, does it have no fat? Okay, good. Or if it has little fat, you're like, good. But then it has all of this sugar, all of these carbohydrates, and then all these ingredients. But, you know, if done right, I think the keto diet has been incredibly useful and therapeutic for many people. But like all these other kind of bio-individual principles, some people, you know, saturated fat or a lot of fat can be pretty bad for somebody's health. So I'm wondering, you know, if you could talk a little bit about, you know, fat and your experience using something like the keto diet.
Well, keto, many people, when they say keto, what keto really is, are two different worlds. Because keto is not very high in proteins either. But when people say Atkins diet is like keto diet, it's really not, because high protein intake is not going to yield the true keto diet. So I am, I'm not the biggest proponent of keto plans, mostly because of the restriction that they are going to ensue, and supplementation will be needed when person does go on a true keto diet, because true keto diet is going to be super minimal in carbs and you have just enough protein to meet your daily needs and everything else is fat. There are some people who are very successful with doing vegan ketos when you are looking at much better cardiovascular outcomes. At the same time, the verdict is still out as far as the cardiovascular implications of high saturated fat meals. There are benefits of, I believe, reduction of inflammation that you can achieve with ketone. I think that would be how cardiovascular endpoints may be impacted and cognitive endpoints may be impacted. But yet at the same time, that's a very heavy burden with animal-sourced fat-based ketos. And also plants like omega-6 fats. I mean, there's a right way and not very healthy way to do keto, which kind of then opened up the door all the other ways how you can restrict and modulate caloric intake and macronutrient intake when it goes to intermittent fasting, restrictive feeding, utilizing things to increase shock protein, mTORs, sauna comes into place. I mean, all these other variables starts coming in. It's kind of, this is like this whole new venture that's currently is big buzzwords around the health
industry. That's why that's, I think what you just mentioned too was so huge where, And this is the problem, in my opinion, of so many of these epidemiological, you know, food and diet studies, which is you can't measure, you can't quantify all of the other factors that go into somebody's health. So when you look at a cohort of people who have, name the diet, keto, vegan, paleo, vegetarian, Mediterranean, whatever it is, and you say, see, they did this diet for 6 weeks and they have healthier markers. But like you said, were they active during those? Were they smoking cigarettes? Were they sitting and watching TV? Were they using sauna? Were they, you know, what was their mental health like, right? Were they around people? Because, you know, people like to throw around the blue zones a lot, right?
Right,
and yeah. The blue zones is more about the influence of community than anything on health. And a lot of people will say, well, see these blue zones, they have plant-based diets and this is why they work, when in fact actually many of the blue zones incorporate a lot more meat and fish than you see advertised around a lot of these different circles. So I guess what I'm saying is I love what you're saying about the keto diet because people evangelize it, but there's so much other context around it.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the lack of protein thing is a big problem for a lot of people because I think people aren't getting enough protein. Mostly, especially going back now to remembering that amino acids are the base of neurotransmitters. Well, you need more protein to, just to keep your body and your mental health stable.
Right.
So, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I'm curious what you think.
And I was kind of thinking like my brain twinkled to like for example food lion's mane. It's because it would influence increased production of the brain derived nootropic factors, and even like taking the diet, be it keto, be it vegan, be it whatever, utilizing some particular foods that are so tropically bioactive could perhaps ameliorate some of the negative effects of whatever deficiency could be encountered by a particular eating plan that person may decide to embark on.
Yeah,
so anyway, it was the brain thing you thought about.
No, that's a great point because you know we could be sitting here and saying, you know, is the keto diet better for, you know, cognition? And they could take all these people and put them on the keto diet, and then some of them might be taking lion's mane, which essentially is going to improve your cognition. And say, see, they did these little tests or whatever, and it turns out they're better. So it's like you can't.
So what really did that, right? And people oftentimes take so many supplements, and I'm going to get healthy. So it comes with a package of number of interventions, not just particular nutritional change. So who's doing what is oftentimes unanswered. And there's some research saying something's helping, something's not. So I mean, also, we need to have randomized placebo-controlled trials to really tell. But how do you randomize placebo-control and nutritional modification if you're eating keto versus Mediterranean, for example?
Right. And how do we know if those supplements really help too, right? Because you can't just have a diet of only supplements for 12 weeks.
Right. Yeah.
you know? So it's like some people might be eating, you know, they might be taking vitamin C and we're trying to do a study on vitamin C, but at the same time, these people are eating, you know, you have some people eating cheeseburgers and hot dogs, you have some people drinking kale smoothies and eating salads or whatever. And then it's like, well, what, how do we even parse that out?
Which one is which, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So you do some really interesting stuff with diabetes. You do diabetes management in your practice. So I'm wondering if you notice any connections between diabetes and mental health.
Oh, absolutely. Diabetes increases risk of depression and anxiety. Also, treatment for diabetes has been, I think it's pretty widely known now that metformin, long-term use of metformin will influence adversely B12 levels, so it may be a good idea to test. Many people go forward and test directly B12. I suggest to test methylmalonic acid instead for those who are concerned about long-term use of metformin. And then diabetes itself, it's increased oxidative damage state of the health, because of hyperglycemia, be it because of the metabolic connections to hyperlipidemia, increased CRPs noticed in some patients. So all of these increased inflammatory markers also impacts the brain. And we know that in patients with depression, for example, there are increased association with depression with increased IL-6, interleukin-6, TNF-alpha. So there is a relationship with inflammation and mental health as well. And so managing diabetes, keeping blood sugars in appropriate level, which is appropriate individual glycemic control for individual patient, I think this paramount step in addressing mental health, as well as addressing mental health, would be important. This kind of have a blend to my professions, and improving mental health allow patients to feel free to practice appropriate self-care and self benefiting behaviors in managing their diabetes, be it exercise, be it medication, be it supplement, be it nutrition, be it sleep, be it testing of the blood sugars, insulin pump management, whatever the objective of the individual patient it may be.
I find diabetes and blood sugar issues to be one of the most complex issues, because you're literally talking about somebody's blood sugar, which controls so much of their emotion and their mood, and it's intertwined with the stress pathway. So, you know, like for instance, the idea of being hangry, right?
When
your blood sugar drops. And so, you know, people have this immediate, you know, knee jerk, like, oh my God, I gotta get my hands on.
It's so easy then to overtreat low blood sugar. And there is this rule of 15 when a person is treating low blood sugar, and for purpose of this conversation, less than 70 upon finger stick, not upon the CGM, continuous glucose monitor, but upon the finger stick, 70 needs to be confirmed. And it's rule 15 grams of carbohydrates, fast acting, which is a glucose tablets of fruit juice, sort of a cup, another source, tablespoon of sugar, which is 15 grams of carbohydrate. And that's it. 15 minutes later, blood sugar should jump about 30-40 points, and then later on you follow up with appropriate meal or snack depending on what time of the day it is and what your objectives are. But this whole consuming a Snickers bar or consuming a sandwich when blood sugar is low, first of all, it slows down the availability of glucose to how quickly it will rise the blood sugar. So you continue to feel low and continue to be low when fat or fiber is included in a meal, and then person will have increased hyperphagia, they will keep wanting to eat more and more and more and more until finally it raises brain's awareness, its blood sugar is going up. And by that point, person consumed way too many calories and ate way too much food that was not on their to-do list to begin with.
And then they fall asleep.
Yeah.
It's such an amazing thing that we've done in, I don't know how it is in other countries, but in America, I mean, I could almost guarantee in other countries, you know, I've been to Mexico and Thailand, these places, but we emphasize carbohydrates in the morning. We encourage people to eat not just carbohydrates, but like the worst forms of carbohydrates, like donuts and bagels and croissants and real sugary cereals. And there is an interplay, right, between glucose and between cortisol, and the cortisol is highest in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And then we guzzle a whole bunch of coffee to keep ourselves awake to kind of counter side effect of what we just had consumed for breakfast. And then we have a drop later on in the afternoon. There is another way of fatigue. So what do? We grab a snack. We grab a sugary snack because it becomes a pick-me-up. And afternoon is typically where your thyroid level goes down, your testosterone is going to be dipping towards the afternoon. So a number of your hormones it's going to give you, perk you up, are going to be going down. So maybe instead just do some, go for a brisk walk around the building in that afternoon instead of, or have a preemptive healthy snack prior to that the dip. Maybe a beneficial intervention instead of waiting till you dip and then you try to climb yourself out of the feeling icky and fatigued.
So do you find then, as you know, in your practice specifically, that people who come in and they're complaining about things like depression and anxiety, that has a lot to do with this different pattern of eating where maybe it's very, you know, sugary carbohydrate centric, especially earlier in the day?
Could be the eating pattern like you're describing so well, could be also an, a reaction to particular substance, be it gluten, be it dairy, be it reaction to sweet potatoes, whatever it may be. Sometimes people can have a particular response that is adverse. It could also be impacting the fatigue. And then also medication side effects. Oftentimes you don't think of it. I like to run medication side effect profile to see what patients are taking. What could be nutrient deficiency could be secondary to that. Also, the disease state. Sometimes it's genetic SNPs. There's just so much that goes into really distilling what is the root cause of this particular symptom presentation, which could be attributable to so many different factors for this particular person, and then addressing it and appropriately for that particular person.
Right. Right, which again goes back to why there's no perfect diet.
Yeah, in the individualist medicine, individual eating plan, individual medication, individual supplements. You mentioned the cortisol earlier. There was a trial looking in Bacopa, which is Brahmi, old ancient Ayurvedic medicine that scholars use to help memorize long hymn and prayers and such. And it tends to decrease cortisol for people who are multitasking. While multitasking. So that was an interesting little trial looking at that. And also there's so much benefit and improvement of cognition and capacity to acquire memory, retention of the memory as well.
Yeah, Bacopa is really one of the kind of OG herbal nootropics that always really shows up to help, especially for anxiety, you know, stress. I didn't know that you mentioned, but I definitely read a number of them where Bacopa is used to lower instances of cortisol, which I would imagine helps blood sugar as well.
Absolutely. And same lines, man, it helps blood sugars as well. Like BDNF that I mentioned earlier, in obesity is associated with this serum decrease of BDNF factors. So there's all so much interplay between our health, our weight, our way of thinking, and trauma that impacts our life too.
Yeah, and maybe you could talk a little bit about trauma because I know you work with that in your practice as well. I find that one to be, you know, to be interesting, and I think often very overlooked on the patient side because you know what they're doing is they're putting supplement on top of supplement on top of supplement, just constantly trying to solve a problem that's not solvable unless you really take a holistic approach and really try to dig at the root of this issue.
Beautiful piece of literature written about trauma that maybe your listeners may like to look at is a book called Body Keeps the Score. Have you read it by chance?
It's called Body Keeps the Score?
Yeah, it's a great book looking at the impact of trauma on the body. And often trauma, as people, we try to adapt to our adverse and positive experiences in life and then proceed with our life the best we know how, with these tools we have available to us. And one of the adaptations sometimes is minimizing trauma. Sometimes it's minimizing the adverse experiences, especially if it is if person learned that you just kind of suck up and deal with it and move on with life, well, or of thinking that, well, it's not happening now, so what's the problem? But trauma is impacting our methylation and acetylation of our histones of DNA, and which will kind of impact what genes may or may not express. That is beautiful research going on in that field. We do know the treatment of trauma can impact the not just emotional experience that typically brings a patient to a therapy, like a depression, anxiety, or panic, or nightmares, but also physiological impact if trauma is a contributing factor. And sometimes complex trauma can present this variety of different manners that could be overlooked, and people just try to manage particular symptoms, like forgetfulness, for example, manage particular symptoms of forgetfulness when truly it is a hypervigilant, hyper response to hyperarousal that is all to the traumatic experiences that may be feeding into that particular symptom presentation.
That's so interesting. The body keeps a score. What a wonderful way to really encapsulate this idea of the subconscious running the system, right? Because mm-hmm. it does, you know, we don't realize it, but our brain, most of it is like you said, it's keeping a score. It's remembering these things that have happened throughout our life and we don't remember them. And I don't remember the name of the therapy, but you know, there are these therapies where I did this in a meditation retreat where, and I did this at a Tony Robbins event too, where, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of fall into this meditative state.
Trance-like state.
Yeah. And then you start thinking about things you hadn't thought about in years. And as an adult now, you know, and this happens sometimes just kind of walking around. I'll just think of like a memory, something that happened 20 years ago and it just pops up. And then if you're really dialed in, which is hard to do, but if you're really dialed in, you start to realize like, oh man, that's still with me. You know, yeah. that thing that happened that I just buried it. I just used my conscious and buried it with, you know, whatever. For a lot of people, it's substances, but you know, you just say, I can't think of that anymore. And then you realize, and it could be so insignificant, but it definitely, and not to get too far off track, but I believe that's what's happening with this whole COVID quarantine lockdown situation. I think this is a very traumatic experience for people. And I think
absolutely. And people are stuck. They have no way to spend time in nature, which is found to be so helpful for mental health and to commune with other friends and family, which is so valuable for mental health at all. It's a lot of me, myself, and I in quarantine, or just with people you and your own nuclear family where you don't always get along, or maybe some people are going to be in danger of domestic violence. So, I mean, again, we're getting off track a little bit. But yes, trauma has such a significant impact on this, and also does the healing of trauma, does the healing from trauma. And you mentioned earlier, like it could be such an insignificant effect. And oftentimes people feel, again, like this is not a big enough deal. Why is it impacting me? But a particularly big enough deal could be really very significant deal, depending on when in the person's life particular traumatic event has occurred, the developmental stage and the vulnerability stage and kind of where they were when that happened. And it can be happen in adulthood or in childhood. It impacts how the person internalizes their view of self and also view of the world. So even though it may be on the outside seemingly and not a big deal event, it could be paramount and foundational for how the person, that individual, will perceive and will respond to the world, be it a car accident, be it a severe assault, be it death of a loved one. It has meaning, and the meaning of the trauma oftentimes is unconscious, but it informs and regulates how we present to the world, how we adapt, how we maladapt to responding to the world.
And in your practice, you use something called EMDR.
Yes, EMDR stands. Yes, go ahead.
I was going to ask you if you could explain what that is. It sounds very interesting.
It stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. It was developed by Dr. Shapiro, kind of accidentally. Now it has really grown, and new protocols were developed. Not every practitioner is going to use eye movements. I in my clinic, I don't always use eye movement, but mostly use the either bilateral stimulation of other source, be it having like buzzing pedals in the hands or audio stimulation, or people can just clap their knees during the process itself. But what EMDR tends to do is allow body to access at the same time our cerebral cortex is fully present, your prefrontal cortex is online, going into the traumatic memory that is stored and involved in the hippocampus and the amygdala, and bring all of those functions, memory places, stores online, and reprocessing traumatic event. And people oftentimes derive to a different, more cohesive, more integrative outlook about self and others and what happened and the world at large, based, of course, on what they're working on when they process. People who are not able to drive a car after car accident can drive. People had anxieties or phobias, those can be decreased. For some individual, it's the very depressive depression or nightmares or flashbacks, this PTSD. So it's been studied very widely and then used both as evidence-based modality in the theoretical world, Department of Defense, and multiple other instances.
Wow, that sounds incredibly powerful, an incredibly powerful therapy. And I'm sure, what do you find is the typical success rate with that, or how long does it take to do that to really start seeing results with somebody?
It really depends. It's not a long-term therapy. You can do other therapy in addition to it, of course, but typically we take one or two. Well, the eight phase approach to utilize EMDR, and only portion of it is actually doing the processing. There is preparation, there is assessment, there is post-intervention assessment. So there is a comprehensive work that goes into trauma processing with EMDR. And typically we have a session of processing per traumatic memory. It's not the traumatic memory, bad stuff happened to me in childhood. It's one specific event at a time is typically processed. So it's going to depend how many one specific events we need to process. It also depends whether or not there are some other what's called theater memories that go into maybe more current presentation. Sometimes people are aware of them, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they show up, sometimes they don't. So it's really individual as well, just like all the other individual approaches we're discussing.
And I'm curious, I don't know if this even makes any sense, but it kind of sounds akin to the idea of like rapid eye movement sleep, REM sleep,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, some literature it looks at perhaps it kind of works, the body can reorganize it as it happened with REM. That's one of the suppositions that we have about how EMDR works. In the end of the day, we don't really fully know how EMDR works, but we do know that we bring a lot of different parts of the brain online and we reprocess. And you are awake when EMDR happens, so you have your cognition, your prefrontal cortex fully engaged in the process as well. It doesn't just happen to you. You come in and intervene as a person who experienced the trauma.
Wow. Yeah. So these therapies are so interesting. You know, I was talking to another doctor about biofeedback, mm-hmm. and it's very, it's not similar, but what it kind of comes back to is these therapies are essentially training the person to make the decision on their own, to essentially do it on their own, by kind of coercing the brain to react in a certain way. So it's like biofeedback is, you know, you show someone a picture and then, you know, you almost kind of prompt an emotion to the picture, and then the person has to respond to that, and that's kind of how they deal with, and that's a very simplistic way of explaining
it. Sure.
But it sounds like this is very much the same thing, where really what you're doing is you're giving the person the stimulus, and then essentially they're using their cognition to essentially realign everything
and emotion. And also brain plasticity that's involved in the process too. And sometimes we need to interject and intervene and help in the process as well. You mentioned biofeedback. I'm certified in heart math as well, which, when you think of the oftentimes of the brain as a director that sends signals to everyone else in every other part of the body, but we do know there is more afferent neurons coming from the heart to the brain and from the brain to the heart. So doing various interventions that involve the heart itself and like beat biofeedback will influence our brain health as well, because so much communication does translate from the heart to the brain.
Wow. There's so much.
It's so fun.
There's so much. And what you said, I feel like I could do a whole other podcast on, because, you know, that's the thing I think a lot about. You know, I do yoga, and, you know, a big thing in yoga, when you have the right teacher, I should say, and my teacher is he's an 82-year-old yogi master. Mm-hmm. And he's not just a yoga master. I mean, he's a guru. He's like a full on, living, breathing, you know, just ancient yogi. But this is what they talk about. They talk about, you know, believing things in your heart, using your heart to really thinking with your heart, right? This is where we make some of our most truest decisions and really encapsulate who we are. So, mm-hmm. So using a form of biofeedback to essentially train the heart to think for you
trust your heart and learn to connect with your heart versus just put all these cognitive shields that sometimes separate us from us, and cognitive shields that separate us from our heart and from all the other deeper parts of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Then that's, I think this is kind of a good place to end it, because, you know, to kind of sum it all up, it really comes down to, we need to think more from our heart, you know, and from our gut too, because our gut is literally making the parts that power our brain. And we don't do that. I don't think a lot of people, I think, who need your services need it, because you almost, in a way, with all of these tools, are trying to help people go back and listen to their heart and listen to who they truly are and bring out that person who they're trying so hard to get to, but they're just not making the connection. And I think that's probably where you come in and help.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So before we sign off, is there anywhere you could lead or you can kind of leave us with the listener, the viewer, where they can find you online, you know, your website, any social media, if somebody would like to work with you? Do you work with people online or virtually? Maybe say
I work with people in the states where I'm licensed to work. So I'm licensed in Oregon, unless the licensure allows some reciprocity. So or out of the country, if it is appropriate, visit particular jurisdiction. I could be found on juliabragdorf.com, https://juliabragdorf.com, and that is the best way to reach me. On
That's
Psychology
fantastic.
Today.
Psychology Today, yes, you have a profile on Psychology Today. Okay, and we're going to link to all of this in the show notes. That can be found at holisticnootropics.com/Yulia. Yulia, thank you so much for joining me today. Any last words you'd like to leave the viewers and listeners with before we sign out today?
Eat whole foods, eat real foods, and that contains a lot of colors, a lot of diversity, and brings joy to your heart.
That's great. That's perfect.
Thank you, Eric.
Eat for your heart. Thank you so much, Yulia, for joining me today on the Holistic Nootropics podcast, for your wisdom, for your practice, for all that you do. And thank you, listener and viewer, for joining us today on the Holistic Nootropics podcast. For more on this podcast, again, go on over to holisticnootropics.com/Yulia. And for all things nootropics, including information on specific nootropics, all the scientific references and guides to using nootropics, go on over to holisticnootropics.com. Thank you so much for listening and viewing, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Thanks for listening. For more brain-boosting info, in-depth articles, and show notes, check out holisticnootropics.com.